Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
My late mother came from a musical family, the Carneys, and she had a beautiful singing voice. Her signature song was the haunting Bantry Bay, but she had a wide repertoire in Irish and English. She also directed the choir for the Irish language mass in St. Michael's Church in Dunlera. My late father, Joseph, on the other hand, well, let me tell you the story he often told us. When he entered St. Patrick's Teacher Training College in Dublin in 1942, he confessed to the music lecturer that he couldn't sing. "Everybody can sing," the lecturer told him. However, as my father told it, after hearing him sing, that lecturer came to admit that there is an exception to every rule. I always felt that Dad might have been embellishing the story a little bit, but then I came across two interesting documents among my father's papers. The first was the results of his final summer exams from 1944 in the beautiful Shanachloe, Principal Unadachish, Clachta Ervunia, Bail Scrudu Gaelga, Slaunt Oliacht, Liniacht, and so on, all with respectable results beside them. But then we come to Kjol, and in the space for his mark was written the word Thayer, or free, presumably denoting that he had managed to obtain an exemption in music. And then there was a typed letter from February 1945 from the president of the college, Jerome Toomey, who clearly thought highly of my father, and was reporting back to him on his endeavours to recommend him for a teaching position in City Quay. He got the following response from Father Thomas O'Donnell, the administrator of City Quay. "I can see my way to overlooking the singing deficiency in Mr. O'Driscoll's case. We are fairly well provided in that department here." So clearly the reports of my father's musical shortcomings were not so exaggerated after all. In fact, I never ever heard my father sing. Not in the bath, not in the shower, not even humming along to a favourite song on the radio. I've been known to break into song myself about the house, but I was always led to believe by my sister and later by my wife that as far as my own singing voice is concerned, it's my tone-deaf father I take after, not my pitch-perfect mother. However, about 2 years ago, I was acting as the announcer on the PA system at the sports day for Sculler Conn, my children's primary school. The day starts with a parade around the field, led by a piper, followed by Auron na Bhfian, played by the same piper. As the piper struck up the anthem, I felt the crowd needed a bit of encouragement to get their rendition going properly, so I started singing into the microphone. "Sine fianna fall, a toffi aulegerin." My efforts didn't seem to cause any obvious distress to the assembled parents and children, and I even received one or two compliments which seemed perfectly sincere. And then, soon after the sports day, a member of the parents' committee approached me to sing the national anthem at that year's sixth class graduation ceremony. At the age of 51, I had received my first invitation to sing in public, and I lost no opportunity to gloat about this to my wife and sister. Meanwhile, the Irish language mass with the choir that my mother directed many years ago continues every Sunday under its present director, Pauline E. Argon. I attend and occasionally read the lessons. I sing along with some of the hymns too, but not as part of the choir, unlike my sister Breed. Until one Sunday last June, when the choir numbers were down to four singers, as many members were on holidays. But the numbers attending the mass were up due to the presence of a cruise ship in the harbour. Pauline told me I was needed in the choir to make up the numbers, and not wanting to let the side down in front of the visiting tourists, I obliged. Tentatively at first, and then with increasing confidence, I sang the hymns. Old hits, as it were, like Deus Meus ad Vime and Arian Downig, as well as Pauline's own beautiful compositions and arrangements. Afterwards, Pauline came over to me and my sister Breed and told me with great enthusiasm how wonderful I had been. "You're the dream team," she told us. My sister looked at me skeptically. But my warm glow and Pauline's praise evaporated when she went on to say, "You really do have a wonderful voice, Fáchnne, just like your father." I think, after all, that it may be time to retire from my short career in public singing.
This story in segments from a woman I queued behind in the Radio Centre canteen in my first few days as a trainee producer in Donnybrook 40 years ago. When she turned from the counter till, she had the most beautiful blue eyes. You could see to the bottom of their sadness, like the wavering sandbed of a Mediterranean anchorage, all turquoise and moist. "You have the most beautiful eyes," I said. I didn't mention the Mediterranean. Now, I was a student with stubble, and she was close to retirement, but she didn't denounce me to human resources. This was still, thank God, the 20th century. Instead, we changed and exchanged a few words, and the styrofoam cup of black coffee burned my palm briefly while she dunked and hoisted her tea bag. Next time we met in the same canteen, I was a probationer. She was thinking pensions. What, she asked, was I working on? Well, I had found a photocopied typescript of a short play by Thomas McDonagh, the revolutionary martyr of the 1916 Rising and former head of my own Department of English in University College Dublin. Admittedly, it was terrible, still. "But it's not about insurrection," I said, or about resurrection. "It's about reincarnation." The woman with the beautiful blue eyes that emerged had been 20 years younger when the jubilee of the Easter Rising was celebrated at every statue in every square of the 26 counties. I was 10 at the time and remembered the two Spitfires flying low over O'Connell Street and the Vanguard who brought me to a barracks when I got lost among smelly trench coats at Nelson's Pillar. Blue Eyes would have been safe and settled in her own workspace, a tall box room off a grand corridor in the Henry Street headquarters of Radio Éireann, tucked in like a squashed shirt tail behind the GPO. "It was Cosc and a Heron breakfast, dinner and supper," she told me. That was right and proper. But I didn't mind being asked to do a My Fair Lady feature on the fly. The film was still running round the corner, and it just so happened that Stanley Holloway, who plays Eliza Doolittle's dad in the film, was staying at the Gresham. He's the dustman who sings, "Get me to the church on time." "I'm getting married in the morning," I sang. "Ding dong, the bells are going to chime," she said. So I looked up everything about him, all the other films he'd made that weren't famous, the old black and white ones that begin with a naked man banging a gong. I actually went round the corner to see My Fair Lady again. "I even read the play it's based on," she said, "George Bernard Shaw's Pygmalion, which is based in turn on a Greek myth about a person called Pygmalion, who turns into Professor Higgins in the play and into Rex Harrison, who can't actually sing a note in the musical." "Talk about reincarnation," I said. "When I met him, he was lovely," she told me. "Not at all the working man he was always cast as. Very dapper, very dignified. I had a dozen questions I was going to ask him, all typed out, and I let him see them before we started. It was smooth sailing. One take, no edits, in the can. He knew the business. He'd broadcast on the BBC during the Blitz, for God's sake. And then I walked him from the building and out the front door. Flags and bunting everywhere, and soldiers practicing their drill for the big day where the stand was being erected at the post office. The story should be in the archives, I said. I'm sure it's in the Variety archives. She told me that the same Stanley Holloway had told her it was good to be back in Dublin. But that wasn't anywhere in the accordion folds of the station archives. He told her it was good to be back in Dublin 50 years later, 50 years after, almost to the week, almost to the Easter week of 1916 itself. That wasn't in the archives either. There was no mention on acetate or reel-to-reel of Holloway, the teenage subaltern in the Connacht Rangers who'd been pinned down under crossfire at a bridge over a river that might have been a canal in the ricochet of chippings and the whiff of hot horse dung. And off he strode, the natty dresser with the military bearing, the flower seller's father, the coal man comic, into a seething Sackville Street, all open-backed buses, duffel-coated students on bicycles with mudguards, and the beehive hairstyle of girls pushing hooded prams towards Lemon's Pure Sweets confectionery next door to the Metropole. I like to imagine that the fair lady with the beautiful eyes watched him disappear. Her turquoise iris must have moistened in the glare and diesel of a midday Dublin pavement. Then a colleague on his way to the Tower Bar clapped her on the shoulder and congratulated her in Irish on her coup. You needed an easy interlude, a respite from the rising, during the mayhem of this Jubilee month.
And girls all over London, and I've got to track them down in just a few more hours.
I'm getting married in the morning.
It's early on a chilly February morning, and I'm making my way through the streets of Paris. Not just strolling aimlessly and soaking up the atmosphere wherever the city happens to take me. Oh no, this time, walking purposefully and with a definite spring in my step, I am a woman on a mission. Because I'm back in Paris for one reason only, to step inside the risen from the ashes cathedral of Notre Dame. And I can't wait to see it. Haven't been able to wait, if truth be told, since the cathedral ceremoniously opened its doors once again last December. And now here I am, in early February, with my 10 a.m. entry ticket stored safely on my phone, striding across Place de la Bastille, turning into the busy thoroughfare of Rue Saint-Antoine, and then, a few minutes later, ducking down to my left along the little street close to the city's Holocaust Museum, walking, 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 until I find myself face to face with the River Seine. I cross over the wide road that runs along the quays and step onto the Pont Louis-Philippe, the bridge that leads straight to the Île Saint-Louis, my favourite corner of Paris. Right beside the Île de la Cité, it lies in the shadow of Notre Dame itself. Despite my mounting excitement as I get closer to the cathedral, once on the bridge, I stop. For as I stand there, I can see it now, just over there to my right, my first glimpse of the majestic towers of Notre Dame. Notre Dame, Our Lady, a lady mourned across the world when the cathedral that had stood sentinel in Paris for 8 centuries went up in flames just before Easter 6 years ago. And now, here she is, risen again. Despite my lack of religious belief, I've always loved Notre Dame. And just standing on the Pont Louis-Philippe for a few quiet minutes on this particular morning, it all comes flooding back. The history, the Gothic beauty, the power and the glory. And personal memories too, like walking around the cavernous church almost 30 years ago with my elderly parents, my mother taken aback by how dark the interior was, my father admiring the rib-vaulted ceiling and finding himself overcome by simply being in the presence of such history. It was within these very walls, after all, he reminded me that afternoon, that Napoleon Bonaparte had crowned himself emperor. And now, following the catastrophic fire of 2019, due to incredible donations and to the painstaking work and boundless expertise of some 2,000 artisans, Notre Dame is back. I take a last look at those twin towers and carry on across the Louis-Philippe Bridge. And from there, I walk to the front of the cathedral and join the short, pre-booked queue. 2 minutes later, and I'm walking through the last judgment entrance door. I'm in. Oh my God. I smile to myself as I stand stock still, thinking instantly of my mother as I look around, gobsmacked, and take in the cathedral's now luminous interior. Well, Marion, I say to her in my head, there's nothing dark about it now. It is stunning. Shiny and light and airy, the former dark and grimy stonework now gleaming in all its cream-coloured radiance. I wander around among the other visitors and worshippers, feeling somewhat overwhelmed. Suspended chandeliers glitter as far as the eye can see. The magnificent stained glass windows refract the morning light. The vibrant colours of the meticulously restored side chapel murals jump out at me as I pass. The cobalt blues and yellows and corals in the little St. Louis chapel would take your breath away. Compare and contrast with those blacker than black, smoke-damaged murals photographed after the fire. Just standing there, staring at them now, it feels like, well, a miracle. I sit down for a moment among the prayerful as I feel the tears rise in my eyes. Gathering myself, up I get a few moments later and on I go. And that's when I happen upon another side chapel, one that is dedicated, in French and in English, to the women and men who saved and raised Notre Dame de Paris. With separate dedications to donors and builders, there's one particularly poignant plaque. In memoriam, it says, of Jean-Louis Georgelin, 1948 to 2023. Jean-Louis Georgelin, the former French army general charged with overseeing the reconstruction of Notre Dame, who died while mountain hiking just a year before the cathedral opened its doors again. Such poignancy and loss in a place that now speaks only of renewal and hope. And as I walk away from Notre Dame, leaving that glorious, light-filled cathedral behind me, I can't stop thinking about Jean-Louis Georgelin, for there's another line on his memorial plaque that's still going around in my head. Là où il y a une volonté, il y a un chemin. Where there's a will, there's a way. If you never believed that old adage before, just look to Notre Dame this Easter and believe it now.
There's a picture of my mother striding down a street in 1938 impossibly elegant. She's wearing a tailored suit with a pencil slim skirt. A clutch bag is tucked under her arm, and topping it all is a jaunty hat. You can't beat a hat. It's all about the tilt. The tilt of the hat, the tilt of the brim. If it's curled back to reveal the face, you can seem young and innocent. If it's dipping over one eye or low enough to shadow both eyes, you're mystery woman. Think Ava Gardner, Ingrid Bergman. My mother liked the bit of mystery. So do I. You can hide a lot behind a hat. I fell in love with hats when I was about 13. I had discovered in our dressing up trunk a boater hat like French schoolgirls wore. I fancied it, so I decided to wear it to Sunday Mass. As I came downstairs, my father spotted it and he burst out laughing. "Would you look at her in the old-fashioned hat," he said. So the hat was thrown back in my room. But I was bitten by the bug. Hats were theatrical. To my cousin's wedding, I wore a Dick Turpin hat with a swathe of black chiffon trailing down behind. One of the aunts was scandalised. "Black chiffon at a wedding," she sniffed. Oh yes, a hat gets you noticed. But for a hat that's really dramatic, go and look in the Patrick Pearse Museum in St. Enda's in Rathfarnham at a portrait by William Orpen of Beatrice Elvery. She was a daughter of the family who owned the sports shops, and she was a progressive artist and illustrator herself. She's painted wearing a black hat with a high crown and a great fan of blue and black feathers springing from it. All this laid on her mane of bright red hair. She looks like a very beautiful witch. She was also the model for the marble bust of Roisin Dubh in St. Stephen's Green, and her face was described by Patrick Pearse as an expression of the soul of Ireland. All these things she may have been, but by God, she was also a woman who could wear a hat. The difficulty for hat wearers these days is finding an occasion. The odd traditional wedding, or maybe the races. Years ago, we had Sunday morning church, where, weirdly, the women had to cover their heads and the men had to bear theirs. So all along the window ledges and the spare seats were rows and rows of men's hats. Up to 50 or 60 years ago, most men wore hats, and you can see it in any outdoor picture of political gatherings or funerals. Hats were big business for families like those of Fianna Fáil leader and Taoiseach Sean Lamass. His father and his grandfather were trained hatters. Indeed, Lamass himself was probably the most nattily dressed and hatted Irish politician of all time. Look him up. Spats and a hat. Mind you, the big danger with a hat is of ever letting it out of your hand. My favourite was a Borsellino. I had spotted it coming through the men's department in Galerie Lafayette in Paris. It was dark brown felt with a three-colour leather band. And when I tried it on, it was perfect. From every angle, it was perfect, except for the price. So sadly, I put it back. When I told my husband about it afterwards, he marched straight back in and bought it for me. I love that hat. I still wear it, but once I had to hand it into a cloakroom. "Would you put it up there on the high shelf?" I begged the attendant. When I came back to collect it, the hat couldn't be found. "They'd look for it," they said. As I pulled on my coat, I found something stuffed in the sleeve. There it was, all squashed up like a child's knitted beanie. "Ah, you found it," they said happily. I was speechless. I did my best, but it never recovered the distinctive dip of its brim. Lesson learned, keep your hat on. Wearing a hat takes attitude. It's not just about how you look, but about how you feel. The hat designer Philip Tracy knows all about that. He was given a President's Distinguished Service Award, a a recognition of members of the Irish diaspora and Friends of Ireland who've done the state or its reputation some service. So among the awardees were people who'd set up departments of Irish literature, who ran theatres featuring Irish dramatists, who had helped Irish immigrants, or who had stood up for human rights. Philip Tracy says simply that he makes hats and that they make people feel better. At the reception afterwards in the Oris for him and his fellow awardees, Philip was surrounded by his many brothers, tall County Galway men, well made as oak trees, with this fine silver birch, graceful to his fingertips, in their midst. You couldn't but be struck by the family resemblances and the family pride in the man who's been described by Vogue magazine as one of the greatest milliners in the world. Hats are about emotion, he says, and I like hats that make the heart beat faster. Boom, boom.
There are many, many crazy things that will keep me loving you. And with your permission, may I list a few.
Last November, browsing in our local pet store, I came across a box with an enchanting picture of a chicken on it. Not a brown barnyard hen like you'd find on an egg box. No, this was a splash of yellow, a saffron puffball of a chick with a cheeky stance and a pretty pink beak. The box contained an electric mini incubator. As I read the instructions on the back, I began to feel a glow of excitement. I bought the box and drove home with the promise of spring perched on the passenger seat. We already keep hens, but by last November, our flock was reduced to just two. Rory, our gentlemanly, if vociferous, light Sussex rooster, and a large white hen called Pecker. Pecker, aptly named, has an unerring eye, a razor-sharp beak and a taste for human flesh. So feeding time was a nightmare. But her eggs are delicious, with a golden yolk, and she laid daily regardless of the season. I decided we were on to a winner here. If we could hatch out four eggs with some of Rory's gentle temperament coupled with Pecker's reliability, we would have the perfect family flock. As I closely studied the instructions in the kitchen, counting out the weeks, I realised our potential flock should be just at point of lay for Easter Sunday. I visualised a brimming bowl of boiled eggs gracing the Paschal breakfast table. After much debate, we set up the clear plastic incubator in our children's old playroom. Our only responsibilities were to top up the water levels inside the incubator and to turn each egg daily. We performed these duties diligently, with painstaking precision. 3 weeks later, I arrived home to hear a faint tapping sound. The following morning, a little beak had poked its way through one of the shells. At lunchtime, a tiny damp chick was staggering round inside, and by nightfall, she was all I had hoped for, a fluffy saffron puffball with a cheeky stance. 3 long days later, we had given up waiting for the others to hatch. "Gluggers," pronounced my mother. We regretfully unplugged the incubator. But Tucker, as she was now known, was no glugger. Vigorous and seemingly highly intelligent, she was eating and drinking successfully in jig time. And when she was not eating, she was chirping. Within days, she began to sprout white pin feathers. Her legs grew longer and a little scaly. But as the weeks passed and she grew tall and ungainly, An unmistakable blast of barnyard odour greeted us every time we opened the playroom door. Soon the smell was pervading the whole house. "You're going to have to be brave," I told Tucker, as I lugged the little coop out to the shed, which she took in her stride. Christmas was thankfully mild. Neither the heavy snowfall of January nor Storm Éowyn ruffled her now luxuriant milk-white feathers. And still she grew and became even more vocal, and sometimes I would look at her and wonder, what if she is a he? By the end of March, Tucker was the size of a small swan, docile in temperament. But why wasn't she laying any eggs? We were already well into Lent, Easter Sunday fast approaching. As we fed her one evening, I confessed my fears to my husband. "Maybe she's a chicken for the pot," he suggested gently. Tucker gave him a long look with her intelligent eyes and then marched back into the safety of the coop. The following morning, she had laid her first egg. It was a little alabaster wonder, white with a creamy yolk. As the days lengthened, Tucker began to lay with a regularity that matched her mother's. It felt like the long vigil was over. The hopes for Easter had become a certainty. "This morning, our table will be adorned with flowers and laden with food. And the centrepiece will be a blue bowl brimming with salt white eggs."
Chicken rhythm, oh, 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 J-Lo. Chicken rhythm, oh, 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 J-Lo. Chicken rhythm, oh, 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 J-Lo. Chicken rhythm, oh, 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 J-Lo. Chicken rhythm, when that rooster starts to crow.
Notre Dame, after Notre Dame de Paris by Gérard de Nerval. Our lady's so antique, a dowager, who might outlive the Paris of her birth, yet come a thousand years, time will fell her giant frame, as a wolf brings down a bull, and, chewing silently, consume her innards, till just a meagre skeleton remains. Sightseers across the world will come to stare and wonder at her cage of bones. But dreamers who remember Victor Hugo will see in vision the cathedral grow before their eyes and rise, rise in glory, a mirage shimmering, a vast new story.
On this morning's programme, we heard My Singing Voice by Fachna Odrishgiol, Blue Eyes and Bell Chimes by Aidan Matthews, Easter Miracle by Rosalind Dee, Keep Your Hat On was by Olivia O'Leary, A Good Egg by Maria Moynihan, and Notre Dame, a poem by James Harper. The music was Gromach Rihu Isa, a translation by Micheál Ócáin of Bach's Jesu Mein Freud, performed by Cór Naomh Mhíle, the choir of the Irish Language Mass at St. Michael's Church, Dún Laoghaire, directed by Pauline Aragon with Charles Pearson on organ. Get Me to the Church on Time, sung by Stanley Holloway and the My Fair Lady Ensemble. Je vous salue Marie, sung by Beatrice Gobin. They Can't Take That Away From Me, sung by Frank Sinatra. And Chicken Rhythm by Slim Gaillard. And that script by Fachna Odrishgiol, My Singing Voice, is dedicated to the memory of Pruntius O'Hermaltig, also known as Frank Hamilton, a member of Cór Naomh Mhíle, who passed away recently. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon. The producer is Sarah Binchy. And you can listen back on the RTE Radio app, on the programme website, or on all the usual podcast platforms. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.